Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest today is Frederick Turner, and we're talking about classicism, nature, aesthetics, and poetry.
Yeah. And this is the poem. Ride this one out. Ride this one out as you have done before. Batten down what can be battened. Reef what can be reefed. Avoid the white seashore. Do not expect a rescue or relief. Endurance is its own kind of relief. The other ships are sinking. You must be hope's light for them, the north star of belief, time's substitute for lost eternity. And so resist the onslaught of sad thoughts, that useless, wavering activity of mind stretched to its raveled uttermost. Resist the hopeless cries, the grim reports. Resist the landsman's way to hate the sea, and hold on for the final sunlit coast.
You know, speaking of this moment and this environment and the politics and so forth, you've probably written about this, although I haven't necessarily read it. I'm just curious for your thoughts on the kind of social media, smartphone, Facebook, this situation of being immersed in this world of just kind of feeds and clicks. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's obviously in a very, very ambivalent way. My interest in cultural evolution teaches me that every time we develop a new means of information storage, transport, and retrieval, it precipitates enormous crises. This must have happened when human beings first learned how to speak. And it must have happened, it certainly did happen, we know about it happening, when people started to write things down. And when you write things down, then you can form empires with all the cruelty of empires. Think of the how could Mesopotamian civilization have done what it did? How could Chinese civilization people for a while wondered how Inca civilization could have managed without a script, but of course they did have a script, but it was chipu. It was the knottings of the strings that we have a way of recording information. We'd had very primitive ways before that, it now turns out, but this revolution where you can articulate very complex things and keep them past the lifetime of a human being. And so what Plato inveighs, he talks about, the damage that is done with writing. You have, enormous crisis with writing. Same thing happens, of course, with print. Europe erupts into 200 years of religious war. It's not going to be easy. I think, though, we're right at the beginning of this process. I do believe in the long run, if we can weather it, if we can hold on, if we can ride this one out, then it's going to be very good for human beings, because it will make possible pan-human kinds of understandings that we can only dream of. But at the moment, our first inclination when we get a new technology is to do two things. One is to use it for war, and the other is to use it for pornography. Then, of course, I suppose you could say the third thing you use it for is vicious and malicious gossip, and the prosecution of envy. The continuance and magnification of envy. We're dealing with human beings here.
A moment ago, you also mentioned environmentalism, and I wanted to ask you also. you'd suggested that the concept of the garden or gardening,
yes,
as a way of productively engaging with nature, and yes. I believe against so-called ecotheism, which kind of sounds like, well, just, you know, don't touch it, don't do anything. Mm. It would be better if we weren't there. Mm. This sense of active cultivation and engagement with nature. Your interest in this idea of garden or gardening as a form of active engagement or cultivation with nature. Could you talk about where that came from or how you work with that idea?
A wonderful, wonderful question. I mean, where to start? I suppose it really, well, the efficient cause to use Aristotle's distinction. At least the occasion, I suppose, okay. where it crystallized was when I planted a garden myself in Ohio when I was teaching at Kenyon College.
Yeah.
And I designed a garden both for the kitchen but also mainly just to make a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And had a nice little patch of land and gardened it. And that taught me all kinds of things about, it reaffirmed that sense of abundance that I'd always had.
Yeah, yeah.
That the problem was not scarcity, the problem was abundance, you might say.
Yeah.
And it also taught me in a much more practical way about evolution, which is, I suppose, for me, the most exciting idea of all.
Yeah.
It taught me about the interdependence of that essentially that everything is gardening everything else. Yeah. Every species is manipulating its environment.
Yeah.
To extend and preserve its ecological niche.
Yeah.
So it's not as if, you know, gardeners suddenly supervened upon the world.
Right,
you know,
right.
we've been, it's gardening all the way down.
Right, right, right.
And bacteria are gardening and so on. Everything is gardening everything else.
Yeah.
And one of the big, for me, big insights that came out of this was that there was an entirely different meaning of the word power than the meaning that was used apparently by everybody. That is, the capacity to compel something to happen.
Yeah.
The second law of thermodynamics says that if you do work, then there's less free energy to do work with.
Okay.
So any exercise of power diminishes and destroys the power itself.
Okay.
And you can see that, for instance, with the, you know, say, the Soviet Union, which started out with almost total power and then destroyed itself by its own power, by the exercise of its own power, by the coercive exercise of its own power. Then I began to see that there's another kind of power, maybe related to what Vic, my father, called the powers of the weak, which is to garden things, you know, to participate in the growth of things. Or maybe you could say, instead of trying to fight the waves, you surf.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to compel people by the law, you can persuade them through argument and poetry.
Right.
This became a very important sort of idea for me.
Yeah.
And then I was, you know, I wrote about this in an essay for Harper's, Cultivating the American Garden. Mm-hmm. And I was then contacted by one of the great leaders of the environmental restoration movement, Bill Jordan. Mm-hmm. And Bill encouraged me to develop this in terms of an environmental philosophy.
Right.
And At this point, the whole question, we were thinking about sort of what you might call the shame or guilt of our big footprint in the environment.
Yeah.
And I began to think about particularly the idea of shame.
Yeah.
And this linked up with some other things which I had been finding in creation myths, which all involved some kind of intensely shameful act. Clearly the whole thing about nakedness in the book of Genesis is shameful, but you look at, for instance, the origin of the Inupiat creation myth, which involves a father pursuing his daughter, a father god pursuing a daughter god, who has run off with a dog, mm-hmm. Killing the daughter's lover, and carrying the daughter back in his umiak, and there's a storm arises, and to lighten the boat, he throws his daughter overboard. His daughter hangs on to the gunwale with her fingers and thumbs, and he cuts them off with his harpoon so that she goes down into the underworld and becomes the goddess of the underworld, Sedna. Wow. But the thumbs and fingers become the beautiful foundations of the Inuit economy, which is whales and the marine mammals. Weird myth. And you look at the Japanese creation myth, it's just as weird.
Yeah.
And so I was then thinking, well, these are all about shame. In some way, shame is the precursor to creation.
Yeah.
That there's some kind of... I started thinking about this in environmental terms.
Yeah.
And Bill Jordan and I kind of developed this into an idea about how to creatively turn shame into abundance. And so we started thinking about ritual, and one particular ritual which is going on now, which is ritual prairie burning. That you don't get a healthy prairie unless the prairie burns.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, many ecosystems require burning from time to time.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why California is in so much trouble is that we have not used the destructive human technology of fire to burn stuff off when we could. So it happens to us anyway, So there was this whole collection of thoughts about gardens, about the shame of physical existence itself, and cultural ways of restoring the connection between human beings and the rest of nature.
Yeah.
And I say the rest of nature. It's not human beings and nature. Human beings and the rest of nature. Nature evolved us.
Yes.
You know, if we're doing bad stuff, then nature's doing bad stuff. Right. You know.
Yeah. Well, this sort of to connect to this, I was also very interested to read a couple of things that you'd written. One about artists and the Texas landscape, and then also about Dallas as a place. Because many people who come to Dallas will say, "Oh, it's the culture there is so commercial, and it's not very refined, and it's not very historical, and the landscape is it's so far from the mountains and the ocean, and it's and they're sort of derogatory." But as a matter of fact, you argue in really the opposite direction for the vibrancy of the kind of culture that's here, and the liveliness and energy, and then also the richness of the artists who deal with the landscape. And I wonder, you've been here for several years now, and I just wonder if you could tell us about kind of your experience of Dallas and how this place looks to you now at this point.
Well, it's Dallas is a perpetual amazement.
Yeah.
I mean, it's it's an exemplification of what can happen if growth is really allowed and encouraged.
Yeah.
And Of course, Dallas is lucky in precisely those things which make it not very attractive as a place to build a city. That is, it's more or less flat.
Right.
The space.
Yeah.
Simply space. It's a vast field of opportunity.
Yeah.
And cultural richness comes out of that. I mean, you think of, for instance, the similar commercial explosion of London in the late 18th and 19th century.
Right.
And the huge, you know, monstrous development projects that were going on, and this sort of wild leading edge technology, often with bad side effects, you know, that consumed that whole part of England. But then at the same time generated this amazing cultural flowering. And you could probably say the same thing about, you know, Florence and Athens and so on. Yes, it's raw, brash, in many cases exploitative. It allows for some of the worst things in human nature. But at the same time, it allows all of our creativity to flourish. And to be less abstract about it, as I continue to live here. I mean, at first it just seemed to be, you know, an enormous opening, so to speak. Among other things, very few people had written about it at all. You know, and certainly not in its terms. They'd mostly written about it in terms of, you know, what has happened to the dear old Texas landscape.
And I
became interested in what is happening to the Texas landscape as a dynamical phenomenon. You know, all these great lakes that have suddenly appeared. You know, and that nature never was in a state of harmony. It's always in a state of kind of vertiginous, almost overbalancing. It's like walking, where we have to lose our balance in order to move forwards. So that was my sense of Dallas at the beginning. Then as I got to know the place more, and I got to know more of the people, I just became really enamored of the place. And the thing about Dallas is that a lot of the best stuff that happens in Dallas, and this is partly because of the economics of Dallas, because of the economic theory upon which Dallas operates, a lot of the best stuff in Dallas is private. And that doesn't mean necessarily that it's exclusive, but in some sense, you know, it's something like the Dallas Institute, for instance, is made up of private persons, but has had a huge influence in terms of developing the great parks in Dallas, and, you know, Trinity and so on, and the bridges and the arts district, and you know, and the all the new building that has been going on, in terms of the cultural building that's been going on, and that in some way, if one looks to the official culture of Dallas, you're not really quite going to find it. It's in a sense the unofficial stuff that's going on that is generating the soul of the place. And in fact, interestingly enough, the soul movement, I don't know whether anybody remembers that, but it was quite important. You know, people like Hillman and Sardello and some of the, I'm missing a few, but there's some of the Moore, the people who were talking about the growth of the soul. This was a Dallas movement. And some of it is, you know, connected particularly to University of Dallas, but to some extent SMU too. And UTD now has its own take on this whole thing. And I've been, you know, trying to be, you know, one of the representatives of that here myself.
You know, speaking of kind of, well, I guess in the connection of economics and capitalism, there one of your books on Shakespeare dealt with economics, and it, you know, one might think that maybe if more literary people had a deeper appreciation of the value of business and economics, there might be a different attitude. I wanted to ask another kind of looking back question. At least a couple of the books that you've written, The Culture of Hope, Rebirth of Value, and sort of setting forward this scientifically informed view of aesthetics and art that's also classical, as we've sort of discussed. You know, so during the, you know, through a lot of the past century, through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there is a sort of dominance of academic modernism and postmodernism, and to some extent, I understand you're arguing against that and maybe pointing out some of the blind spots that sort of establishment had. But I wanted to ask, you know, by now, let's say in 2019, have things changed? I mean, is that dominance of modernism and postmodernism still there, or have things shifted since you wrote those books?
I think things have shifted to some extent. I mean, it depends which area one is looking at, but certainly, let me try to run over a few areas. I think there's definitely been in music, even in so-called serious music, there's been a kind of, you might say, a rediscovery of melody. And a questioning of the distinction between serious music and, you know, popular and folk music. And this, how can I put it? Well, perhaps if I put it in the context of what's happened in the visual arts, that abstraction no longer rules the visual arts. It's still going, as it certainly should. I mean, why shouldn't, you know, really wonderful, brilliant wallpaper be, you know, be a real art? You know, beautiful figured wallpaper be a real art. There's been, I think, a recovery in all kinds of ways of representation, of the idea of representation. And again, I would relate this to our greater understandings of nature. That is, we now see that nature is itself full of representation and signaling and so on, even down to, you know, a certain kind of plant that grows leaves that are shaped exactly like a certain kind of butterfly, so that the butterflies will not land on them and lay their eggs, because the butterfly is not going to land on another butterfly and lay its eggs. You know, what you've got here is a tremendous sort of arms race of representation going on. But in a sense, this goes all the way down. I mean, that is, you know, even an elementary particle is identifiable only by the difference between the energy input into it and the energy output from it. In other words, it is in some way representing itself to everything else in the universe. So there's a collective representation that is going on all the way down. The critique of representation by people like Greenberg, Clement Greenberg and so on, was just philosophically wrong. So if one thinks about melody as being really a kind of, it's abstract clearly in one sense, but in another sense it is a kind of structuring of time into a kind of story. And it's a little bit in that sense like representation.
Yeah.
And so it's coming back there. And of course, in poetry,
yeah.
Although the new formalism is a minority movement in the in poetry,
yeah.
these days it would be hard to find a creative writing teacher who didn't feel that they at least ought to show okay. somebody what a sonnet was.
Yeah.
Whereas 20, 30 years ago,
okay.
that would have been thought of as being, you know, wrong.
Right.
There were even, for instance, art schools which forbade the teaching of drawing,
right.
a still life drawing. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
and you could say the same thing in drama, that yeah. essentially, in many ways, we've gotten through the whole notion of the alienation effect, of Fremdung's effect, the whole
yeah.
notion that, you know, people shouldn't be identifying with the characters on stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're making drama that is you know, dramatic in the old sense.
Yeah.
And here I don't mean to sound too conservative. I'm talking about the rediscovery of ways of making meaning that are always revolutionary.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Well,
Now I didn't talk here about the academic humanities,
right.
but I would say that that there is a sort of I've seen books recently. There's a wonderful book on Homer recently. I've seen a number of books that seem to be aimed at a non-academic audience that people are actually reading.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, one need only look at what people are doing at the Undermain Theatre, for instance, you know,
okay.
with this wonderful Homer, this wonderful Iliad, and
wow.
And recreations of all the versions of Shakespeare. I mean, Shakespeare
yeah.
is still going strong and so on.
Yeah.
That in some way, although for a long time, the academic literary world was teaching more deconstruction than it was teaching anything else,
right,
and
right.
then was teaching more politics than anything else.
Yeah.
And but that in the cultural world in general,
right.
There's a great deal of access now to the classics, and people are hungrily. You know, eating it up.
Yeah.
You need only think of, you know, summer blockbusters.
Yeah.
That have recovered all of the great epic tropes
yes,
from
yes.
the, you know, from the epic tradition.
Yeah.
You know, against anything, you know, any theorizing about the novel by, you know, people what's his name?
Not Lukács, no.
Lukács oh, and, yeah. and not the one I was thinking of, but Lukács and I can't remember
yeah.
his name, but you know the whole notion that the novel was the new form and the epic
right,
was
right.
you know something just you know to be thrown in the dustbin of history and
yeah.
so on. The epic has come roaring back, and you know or even you could say you know we get rid of meter.
Yeah.
We don't teach meter, and so what you have is a whole ethnic community that
right.
comes up with rap,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
which is meter.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
Well, that actually. So my last question, at least for now,
yeah.
is that you've written epic poems, Genesis, the New World, Apocalypse, and then that's also in your work. It's tied in with science fiction, and so this connection between this kind of the most ancient kind of form, that going back to Homer and Virgil, with the most futuristic, you know, I think it shows this kind of deep connection, of course, of what human dreams and human imagination and so forth. But I'm curious when you present it to let's say to students or the public, do people see how it all fits together, or is there the kind of prejudice that, well, there's, you know, Homer belongs in one corner and science fiction in another? And I'm curious what kind of responses you get from people.
Well, you know, once the case is presented to them,
yeah.
I think, you know, I do very often see sort of little lights go on in their heads, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that in a way, certainly you could say that supposing you were a Greek of Homer's time, and you heard about all the stuff that Odysseus does, that would be science fiction to them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
that's great.
Or Milton, you know,
right.
The, you know, wars in heaven using artillery and stuff.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
I mean,
amazing.
that's science fiction, you know,
yeah.
Sort of space travel. I mean, Satan does space travel.
Yeah.
You know, so that it was always around. We just didn't call it that.
Yeah.
I mean, there has been a lot of resistance. I mean, I think in a way the resistance is good because it actually does. You know, when we have cognitive dissonance about something, when we encounter cognitive dissonance, that's always an opportunity for thought. You know,
Absolutely.
If the cognitive dissonance were not there, then people wouldn't be thinking.
It's genius. You know? Fantastic. Well, this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Frederick Turner. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for letting me come and hold forth.
Absolutely. The Athenaeum Review podcast is produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.